all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We're in the shadow of the Marine Corps birthday a couple of days ago, and by now they should be sober again. So we will do a couple of programs today, interviews that focus on the Marines, but have some of interest to everybody. Certainly everybody was in Vietnam is going to like this first story, getting the real story about the Marine Corps deadliest sniper in Vietnam. And then we're going to do something on Camp Lejeune that came out recently, and we turned to one of our attorney experts to update us on that. So stick around, both interesting stories for you today. We'd like to welcome to Veterans Radio today Jim Lindsay out in beautiful Oregon, and he's going to talk to us about a book he wrote, The Sniper, The Untold Story of the Marine Corps' Greatest Marksman of All Time. Jim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. When it caught my attention and I got the book and read through it, I was really excited because I learned something that changed my perspective, because I didn't know about Chuck Mawhinney, another good Oregon guy, and served in Vietnam. Actually, he was in your neck of the woods, but for the longest time, you didn't know who this guy was or what he had done. Tell us how you came about writing the book.
In 1979, my brother and I bought a ranch in eastern Oregon. We're farmers. So I moved over to Baker City near the farm that we'd bought, and I met Chuck Mawhinney. We were pretty young fellows then, and we both liked drinking beer, and there was a tavern called the Idlehour. It was kind of a mill tavern, and he worked for the Forest Service. And if I was in town about quitting time, maybe getting parts from somewhere, I'd stop there and have beers with him. And he's just a great guy to socialize with.
But he had grown up in rural Oregon, always was outside kind of guy, and you know, all his buddies in the neighborhood had BB guns and were shooters, if you will. So when he got into the Marine Corps, he kind of was looking at Camp Pendleton to move his way over to Scout Sniper School, and he was able to do that, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was kind of like things happen to people's lives. It was accidental. He joined the Marines right out of high school, 1967, and they sent him to Camp Pendleton for his basic training. And he wanted to be an aviator. He wanted to fly for the Marines, and so they. The night before the test he was to take for aviation training, him and another two guys went out and did the town up, and he woke up in a movie theater at 5 o'clock in the morning. And he, I mean, they really did a good job. So he didn't do very well in the test. So he was going to have to wait around for another month, and they had him washing dishes. And in the meantime, the Scout Sniper School opened, and that caught his eye because he'd loved shooting, liked to hunt and that sort of thing. So he signed up for that, and so that changed his life right there. And he, no one knew, including him, that he would be the best of the best before it was over.
Well, and you talk about how, you know, life it doesn't always go as you planned or as unplanned. He he got into sniper school. He graduated top of the class, and they said, well, great, you're going to Da Nang. Off to Vietnam, young man, May of 1968. He gets over there, and what assignments do they give him?
Oh, it was heartbreaking for Chuck because you know, getting on that plane, he was one person, but getting off in Vietnam, the cards had changed. They just herded him off the tarmac there like a bunch of cattle, and he ended up in a just regular Marine outfit as a grunt. And he did speak up about it, but they weren't looking for snipers; they were looking for just regular ground pounders. And so he ended up in an outfit that guarded a bridge up north, and it was pretty quiet, and he was there for a few weeks, and then they moved him south down just west of Da Nang, and there was big battles going on there. And that's when he was in an outfit, and they were under fire, and he witnessed a guy next to him was killed. He was a machine gunner, and then Chuck started helping his helper, and he got shot, and then Chuck got the machine gun, and he knew if something didn't change, he wasn't going to make it home. And so he was able to finagle around and get into a outfit that had a sniper platoon, and that was about 20 miles west of Da Nang in a place called An Hoa.
He knew that the machine gunners were very vulnerable. Obviously the enemy wanted to take them out, and he had trained and proven himself to be that he could be a sniper. It was an excellent shot. But again, you know, any of us who've served, the military knows better than you. So they started, well, you're a grunt. Well, now you're running the machine gun. And he knew he would be better off on his own, protecting other Marines as a sniper, and kind of forced his way into, as I read the story, The Sniper by Jim Lindsay. He kind of forced his way into that sniper group by first being a scout and then, you know, if you will, moving up the ladder to a sniper, where he was obviously extremely effective. But it really was sort of not as planned as maybe that Chuck thought it was going to be on his way over, did he?
No. Chuck Winnie is a special individual. This book starts when he's just a child, and you can see him and I both wanted it to start early in his life, so that the people who read, the reader, would find out what kind of a person, you know, turns into a successful sniper like he was. So He was really well. He had the ability to talk himself into some pretty neat situations in his life, and he got a job at the Ford dealership in Lakeview when he was just 15, and a great job for a kid. And he got his own pilot's license when he was still in high school, and he was just amazing. And so when he got in that predicament, he handled it well. He faked a toothache, and he got into ANWA, and was able to talk to the platoon about becoming a sniper. And when they found out his record, that he got to be a spotter for another fellow, and there he was, and that's how it started.
Yeah, and it is a good way to introduce people to what it takes to be a sniper, because these are regular guys who have extraordinary skills in this area of patience, breathing, reading all the signs that you need to read as a sniper or as a spotter, because you're out there all alone. You're maybe shooting a long distance, but to be an expert marksman, you've got to have a lot of additional skills, don't you?
Yeah, all this was new to me. I learned so much about talking with Chuck about how it worked, and he was real patient with me. I'd forget what he'd tell me, and we met over a dozen times, and he lived 400 miles from me, or he does. In fact, as I talked to him this morning, and he taught me what it was to be a sniper, and one of the most important things is to know where you're at all times. And when he went through sniper school, they had a lot of training on being out in the absolute darkness and know where you're at. And so he was really handy for some of the outfits that they kind of borrow me. He was kind of like a gun for hire, him and his spotter. They were always together. And of course, there was multiple spotters that came and went, and most of them got to be snipers of their own. He would go out with an outfit, and they used him pretty hard as far as he was about his ability to know where he was.
Situational awareness comes through right in the book, and it's one of those intangibles that gets talked about. As I say, you got to have a real backbone and discipline and patience, but that situational awareness saved him more than once in Vietnam. And he had some pretty amazing kills, but you kind of lose the essence of the man if you just focus on the kills, because he also struggled with the commandment, thou shalt not kill, and he struggled with when he come home after his first tour. He kind of didn't, he knew he didn't fit in anymore. So there's a lot of stuff bubbling in the pot of Chuck Mawhinney as he's going through living this about 2-year period where he's becoming this top sniper. How does he reflect on all that, I don't know, turmoil that was going on in his head?
You know, calmly. Fortunately for him, he's a person that can handle things like that. And a lot of it, I think, was probably the way he was raised. His dad was a Marine, but he wasn't raised to be a killer or anything, but he was raised to do a good job of whatever he was going to do. And that was his job, was to protect and save other Marines' lives. And that's how he justified it. Right before he made his first kill, he saw a Marine killed out in a field, and the NVA was they'd walked into this NVA outfit, and then it was a kind of an ambush, and this fell out in the front, he was pinned down out in the field, and it was awful. They didn't kill him fast. It was hard on Chuck, and so then it wasn't long, and then he was doing the shooting, and he became kind of bitter when he saw what they did to his fellow Marine, and so that helped. And then after the first one, then it was, he just did his job, and He was awful good at it.
Yeah, the story that you've written, the sniper on Chuck Mawhinney, Marine sniper in Vietnam, really gets across this idea that in his psyche, every kill that he's making is saving countless Marines. And that's his job. You said one of the things his upbringing was, if you got a job, do it well. He understood his job was to protect these other Marines, and as a result, kept doing his job as a sniper for the. Actually, I think he did three tours, didn't he, over in Vietnam?
Yeah, he did the first one in the Marine Corps. 13 months, the first tour, and that's when he went home. And you mentioned that his friends were still just kids and. And he couldn't, he saw right away that they didn't have any clue or didn't understand. And the Vietnam War was different than all other wars where they didn't really want to know. And so I think maybe that might have been why he never told anybody until he was outed by another author later on. But he was home, you know, and he just wasn't welcomed by his peers, even the grown-ups around town. They kind of looked the other way. And, of course, his family, he spent a lot of time with his family during that month. And then he decided that his real friends, the real people that he could depend on, were back in Vietnam. So he went back and did another tour where he finished out with his 103 kills. And so he went home again and signed up for a third tour, but he realized that they wouldn't let him be a sniper for another two tours was the max. And he wanted to be a helicopter side gunner, and he got back over there and they wouldn't let him do that. And so he became kind of a policeman, and he did a good job of that. That wasn't his deal, but and then he got the last one. Then he went back to San Diego, and he was a cook until somebody noticed who he was, and then he got to be a rifle instructor, and he liked that.
Well, again, the military always thinks it knows what it's doing best. They take an expert marksman and make him a cook. Just crazy. But one of the things that one of the stories in the book is about Valentine's Day in 1969, which really was a real test for Chuck Mawhinney. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's probably the one event that he's most known for. And he'd been there a while, and he had been, I think it was just right into his second tour. He was out with a company of Marines, one that he worked for fairly often. His the CO was Mike Wiley, and it was during a storm was coming in, and they were dug in at a perimeter, and there was a little airplane come flying over like a Piper Cub, American plane, and the guy radioed down to him, said that there was a platoon or a battalion of NVA across the river, and he was afraid they were going to cross. And so single-handedly, Chuck Mawhinney, after dark, with a starlight scope and his spotter with him, stopped it from happening. And it was just an amazing feat that what he did. And shooters have tried since then. He shot 16 NVA in 30 some seconds. This was according to the spotter. And it turned them, it discouraged them, and they never tried to cross again. And they've tried to set up games where people have tried doing this and nobody can do it. They have 16 targets that pop up, and it was really an amazing think that he was, I don't, who knows how many Marines he saved, because they'd have crossed that river, they'd have went right over those Marines.
Yeah. And it's, as you write in the book, The Sniper, and we're talking to Jim Lindsay, it is, again, some of that situational awareness. After the plane radioed down, he knew right where to go, where to find a hide that was the right spot to stop them crossing the river and overrunning the Marines that he was with. And again, being able to knock down 16 NVA in such a short time, this amazing feat. But it's all those other things too. It's all that, those intangibles, having the right heartbeat, breathing pattern, calmness, patience, situational awareness. It's really an amazing feat that I don't think most of us would do. Our adrenaline and our heartbeat would be going crazy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you might just one of the there was a guy came across, a guide, and stood right beside Chuck. This was in the dark, and Chuck says he was so close to me I could hear water dripping off of him, and he wasn't going to let him get past him. He was about ready to dispatch him, and the guy turned around and went back across, and then it was just a few minutes before they all came or started across. But yeah, he was pretty cool about things.
Yeah, cool. That's true.
That's
an understatement. Now, I want to talk a little bit about, because Chuck only stayed in for a couple of years, got out of the Marine Corps, came back to Oregon, and went into the Forest Service, and completed his whole professional career, I think, in the U.S. Forest Service, had a family, kids, the whole thing, which, again, is this sort of like, okay, I close that chapter of the book. I'm not bragging about it. I'm not telling anybody about it. And you kind of stumbled on it. And only because you were really friends was he willing to open up and help tell the story and have the book written, if I understand it right.
Yeah, that is he actually did go – they were he was in Vietnam when they were starting to slow down, and he got out early because of that, and then he went back to Lakeview and started his next part of chapter in his life, and with his credentials as being a Marine helped him get on with the U.S. Forest Service, and so then right away they were moving him from here to there. And just like everything else he ever did in his life, he excelled at it. He became a machinery operator, built the roads and that sort of thing. And it wasn't very long and he was the boss. And so at first, or not gradually, he had some trouble. He didn't know what it was. You know, it was a terrible. I mean, you talk about going from a high of what he was doing over there for 2 years down to driving a bulldozer.
Right, right, yeah.
And he didn't tell anybody because he knew there was nobody that would ever understand except for another sniper. And but he didn't go around with a sign looking for one. And so There was some turmoil going on inside of him, and he became a heavy drinker, and not like I think of an alcoholic, but I mean he was hit the tavern after work every day, and sometimes pretty late, and it was some things were bothering him, and I don't even know for sure if he even really knew it, but he lived right on the edge until he met a gal, and that was another Forest Service worker, and her name was Robin Hood, and she was a few years younger, and they hit it off, and so they had a family, and three nice boys, and they're all doing fine, and she kind of helped him come out of it. I don't even know if she would. She didn't even know it. He didn't tell her about it either. And the only way it happened to come out is his last spotter Joseph Ward wrote a book called Dear Mom. And
That was the outing. You mentioned it earlier that Chuck kind of got outed, and it got confirmed that he had 103 confirmed kills, another 216 probable kills, and a confirmed kill required an officer to see it occur and be ridden up, and that outed him as the highest sniper marksman number. While most of the world for a long time thought it was Carlos Hatchcock, who had 93 kills, a good Arkansas boy who did a 20-year career in the Marine Corps. And Chuck must have just been happy to let Hatchcock have the glory, and he'd just stay out of it and keep a low profile. And that's one of the things that caught my interest in your book, The Sniper by Jim Lindsay. It's the untold story of the Chuck Mawhinney, the Marine Corps' greatest marksman of all time, because I knew the Hatchcock story. I'd never heard the story on Chuck Mawhinney.
Yeah, that it surprised everybody, and Chuck wasn't really ready for it. It came out, and then all of a sudden he was interviewed by I think the L.A. Times, it was no way he was going to stop it. You know, it was out of the bottle then. And so he had quite a time with it. Some of his friends kind of got cold and he didn't know why. The time it happened, I was over in Eastern Oregon for 20 years running this ranch. And then my parents and family, everybody's getting older. So I kind of wanted to come back. And so I come back, and my brother and I are partners, and we raise grass seed here for lawns and pastures and that sort of thing. And so I came back on the west side. And one evening I was sitting there watching TV, and there was Chuck Mawhinney. And it was on the History Channel or something. And it was him, and I couldn't hardly believe it. And then they're talking about all the stuff he did, and I thought, oh my gosh, I just had no idea. So I called him up, and by that time I had been writing books, and he knew, you know, he remembered me and everything. So we talked about the whole. And I said, you know, somebody ought to write about you. And I went over and visited, stayed all night in their house and everything. And they decided to go, let's do this. So.
Well, it's important for a lot of reasons to get history out and the records out. That's why we've been doing Veterans Radio for 20 years now, telling veteran stories. I thought the article in the Los Angeles Times that was written, the headline captured it, I thought, a sniper at peace with his duties. And I really think that captured Chuck's ultimate position here. I'm not surprised to hear that when he got back, you know, he had difficulties and turmoil in his own head and drinking maybe more than he should have. I think everybody did come back and have years and years of transition to get comfortable with the Vietnam War, and I'm not even sure we're comfortable with it today. But your book does a great job. It's an easy read. I really tell people that if you want to know about the greatest Marine sniper, this is the true story. Jim, where can they find the book?
You can get it, of course, online. You know, Amazon. There's several different outfits you can order it from. It's in the major bookstores and even some small ones, but. You can get it at the New York City Airport.
There you go. It's everywhere.
That was a thrill for there's a lady here in Corvallis, Oregon. It's she's my editor, and she's about my age. And this has been a real thrill for her too, as of me. The book has been so well received, and I'm happy for Chuck. And so as she was on a little trip and went through the airport there, and there was the book that she was, you know, she was involved with so much. And
yeah.
Well, really tickled her. But, so you can get it anywhere.
It's a good read. I encourage folks to do it. And Jim Lindsay, I appreciate you taking some time with Veterans Radio today, and certainly pass along to Chuck Mawhinney our thanks for what he did to save all kinds, untold numbers of Marines back in the day in Vietnam. So, Jim, thanks for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me on here. I really, you do you got a nice deal here, and you do a good job of it.
Thank you. So now you know who the deadliest sniper was in the Marine Corps. Not one who got the most publicity, maybe, but now he's getting his due. Stick around and listen to a couple of words from our sponsors, and then we're going to talk some more about toxic water at Camp Lejeune and some opportunities for those who were exposed to be compensated.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome back to Veterans Radio one of our go-to experts, Attorney Catherine Grohl. Catherine, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. It's good to be here.
Well, we've had you on a couple of times, and we had Mike Cox. You're a partner at the Mike Cox Law Firm on before. Mike is a Marine, was the Attorney General for the state of Michigan, and now in private practice. And one of the things you guys are doing is working on these Camp Lejeune federal lawsuit that got created out of the Camp Lejeune Justice Act. So we've had you to talk about the act in general and the time frame. Why don't you remind everybody what the act allows Marines who were at Camp Lejeune to do and what the timing is on that?
Absolutely. The PACT Act was an umbrella statute legislation that was designed to figure out some compensation for all of the toxic exposures that the various veterans have been exposed to throughout the years all over the world. One section of that has to do with all of the Marines that were in Camp Lejeune from August of 1953 through December of 1987 and may have been exposed to a variety of horrific chemicals in the water table there that have led to a number of terrifying illnesses and diseases for which they may qualify. The PACT Act allows you to bring a administrative claim with the Department of Navy within the 2-year period from when the legislation was signed, which was August 10th of 2022. And you have until August 10th of 2024 to apply to the Navy for an administrative claim relating to your illness and disease criteria. After that 6-month administrative period, you are entitled to go to the litigation component of it, which is run by the Department of Justice, and that's in North Carolina by statute. Those judges in the federal court will be in control of what happens there.
And what's so significant also is that typically you can't sue the, if you're in the military, you can't sue them for nothing. And so this created this opportunity in North Carolina for this specific set of exposures over that period of time. And I read somewhere, Catherine, that something like over a thousand individual federal lawsuits have been already filed.
1,100 as of yesterday.
Okay. And on the administrative side, which is kind of a step towards, if you don't resolve it there, then you can file in litigation down in North Carolina, something like maybe 90,000 administrative claims. Is that kind of the number?
93,000 as of yesterday.
So, you know, there's a lot of men and women who are involved in this. Some family members also have some rights, as I understand it.
Family members do, as well as the civilian employees who are employed on the base and provided administrative services in support of the Marines.
So this is really pretty comprehensive, and if you pass through Camp Lejeune, it's probably something you ought to be thinking about. But as I said, we've had Mike Cox on before, we've had Catherine Grohl here on before, but there's a new wrinkle, if you will, a new opportunity to discuss kind of what's going on, and it's you sent this over to me, and I read the issued public guidance on elective option for Camp Lejeune Justice Act claims. And as I'm reading this, I said, no, nobody other than a Philadelphia lawyer is going to be able to figure this out. who the heck dreamed this up?
It's pretty dense reading, isn't it?
It is. So I thought, well, I'm going to get one of the experts on to talk about kind of what was behind this, and it's hot off the press, if you will. Probably nobody's gone through it yet, but talk to us about this new public guidance on elective option.
Well, I think one of the biggest things that we should recognize is that finally we do have an acknowledgement from the United States government that they have responsibility for what took place on Camp Lejeune, and they're going to have to value it and pay and compensate those people who were damaged. So we have at least an acknowledgement from them that that is not in dispute, those things. What has happened is that the Department of Navy, with these 93,000 cases, has not made a single settlement offer. And when we went to the hearing in North Carolina, the head judge of the North Carolina Eastern District Court made it very clear that they expected offers immediately to be made, because he wanted the money in the hands of the vets, and he could not understand why all this time had passed, a year already, and the Navy had not made a single offer. So this is in partly in response to the judges being angry that nothing had been done yet. So that's the first thing that I think everyone needs to understand, is that the judges are adamant that things start moving in a much quicker pace to get money into the hands of the vets.
Well, if you don't, otherwise everybody just suffers with these diseases and dies. I mean, you know, it took an act of Congress for this to get looked at. And I'm not too surprised the Navy, which probably didn't have enough lawyers to deal with this problem when they got dumped what'll be 100,000 plus claims on them, they had to say, well, geez, is there any model we can use to try to find our way through this? Because we can't try 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 of these claims.
Right. I think, truthfully, they were caught off guard. They weren't prepared economically in terms of staffing, or economically in terms of the high level of technology that they would need so that proofs could be submitted with the claims. They don't have sufficient portals, and they're not capable of taking in all of the data. So they're behind 10 months, even in processing any of the claims that have been submitted.
Well, this 10-page public guidance on an elective option is, as I said, pretty dense reading. And I talk to us what they thought they were doing in terms of setting up this elective option grid and process.
So the idea was to allow all of the vets who meet a certain level of criteria what's called an early out or elective option, and meeting certain criteria that is not in the statute, they could get quicker compensation. But the more Mike and I dug into this, we realized that there's so many landmines and roadblocks built into what you would have to do to get to these settlement proposals that they're making to even get an offer.
So that's one of the things I wanted to comment on. This elective option, if you say, yeah, I want to do that, it doesn't commit them to settle with you, does it?
No, it does not. It is not an offer. It's a proposal for an offer. Very different. You can't just say, okay, I'm in, and they're going to write a check in 60 days. There are about 22, I think, hoops we counted that you're going to need to jump through to see if you can even get to that point.
Well, one of the things that they tried to do, and this is typical, you sort of try to make things very objective versus subjective. Hey, how long were you at Camp Lejeune? Was it a 30-to-1-year exposure, 1 year to five, more than five? So one of the things they do is break it into length of time, and then they also break it into what they called Tier 1 qualifying injuries and Tier 2 qualifying injuries, which I thought was kind of an interesting approach. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yes. And, you know, one of the things I want to make sure your audience understands is that this proposal is not in accord with the statute. The statute does not require any of these time frames. It doesn't break illnesses down into categories. There's no references to any of this in the statute. This is something that the Department of Navy and Justice came up with on their own that is just for this particular administrative process. So one of the things that they did was they reduced the number of illnesses that qualify in this elective option. They not only reduced them, but they also decided to create a stratus of what they considered to be a higher level injury versus a lower level injury. We have no idea what they're using to make those categorizations. It's not disclosed to us. So
that's actually one of the things I found kind of offensive here. They decided that, take your pick here, liver cancer or kidney cancer or bladder cancer were tier ones, and that Parkinson's disease and kidney disease were tier two. And if you know anybody suffering from Parkinson's disease, it's horrible on not only them but the whole family for a really long period of time.
You just raised what we think is one of the most significant and important points. Pain and suffering is what we are asking our vets to be compensated for. Putting these numbers on how long you were there and what your illness is does not in any way take into the individual's struggles, their family issues, the loss of quality of life for anybody. It lumps everybody into group. I'm just going to give you an example. We have a client that had liver cancer. He treated for 4 to 8 weeks. His tumors were removed, and he's going on to live a healthy and productive life. We've had other people that went through chemotherapy and radiation therapy and died in 3 years, a long, slow death. And yet, they're valued at the same, but the one who died is going to get $100,000 more, which Mike feels like, if that's what you're telling us a Marine's life is worth, you better rethink your position.
They're proposing to offer settlements that range from $100,000 to $450,000, if you, and maybe throw on another $100,000 if you actually died from that injury. So the maximum offer is $550,000 per veteran.
Offer without really teeth in it, and I'll tell you why. Almost every one of the clients has been there less than the year. Camp Lejeune is a training base. Typically, most vets are rotated in and out for a series of months for training, and then they're sent overseas or to another duty station. So the majority of people are probably less than 1 year of exposure. In order to get to the 1 to 5 years of exposure, and here's another example, we have a client that was there for 1 year and 2 weeks. Well, the Navy requires that we remove his annual leave. So once we take out his 30 days of annual leave, guess what? He doesn't make the 1 to 5 years exposure. So finding someone that makes 5 years or over that was stationed at Camp Lejeune is almost impossible to find. It's very rare that someone would stay there for a period of 5 years or longer. So that higher number is not really reflective of the majority of people who could even get that.
It also rang for me a little bit, and I didn't research this. I'm sure others have, but you know, there had to be a grit or an approach for the victims of 9/11, who the firefighters and first responders, and other sort of catastrophes where the government has said, "Hey, yeah, that's our fault. We're going to pay you for some." This just doesn't seem like it matches up to those other things. Is my general feeling right or wrong?
It's right, because one of the other concerns that we have is the limitation of 35 years. If it's 35 years past the last date that you are at Camp Lejeune where you get diagnosed and treated for some of these diseases, you're not covered under this proposal. Now, again, that's not in the statute that it has to be manifest itself within 35 years. And the litigation side of things, there's no limitations on that. If you have a direct link and we've got VA disability statements and we've got doctors writing letters connecting the dots between the illness and the exposure, regardless of how many years ago it was, you've just routed out a whole group of people who are never going to be eligible.
A lot of times the government issues these in, federal register, and they solicit comments on them, and then the rules might change. This isn't really a rule. It's a guidance. But is there a process that they've encouraged for the Navy and DOJ to say, okay, we're putting this out here, but tell us what we got right and what we got wrong? Or is this a, hey, this is our position, move on?
This is our position, move on. This is not subject to discussion. And, you know, one of the things that Mike was concerned about is the way it was done. Typically, if there's a legitimate offer being conveyed, it's conveyed through the attorney to their client. You don't publish it on a public website for everybody to see and run big numbers past them to where that's what they're seeing and hearing. And then when they get into the fine tooth details of 11 pages of qualifying factors to even get to this money. So it was kind of a misrepresentation in the way they did it. And they circumvented every attorney having a meaningful conversation with their client about this.
This doesn't seem like it was designed to get a bunch of settlements as much as designed to say maybe to the court, well, we did something.
Agreed. Just as an example, if you met all of the qualifying conditions and your illness manifested itself in the time frame that they asked you for, I still can't get you a proposal or an offer because they are demanding that I get certified original records signed by a doctor certifying that they're original. I can't do that. Many of these records are destroyed. Some of them are on microfilm that we had to get. We had to hire a retrieval company to go into all these doctors' offices to get copies of records. They're not originals. They're copies. And you have to have the original to apply for this proposal. We can't do that. We don't have the ability to do that. And people are going to get left out that way. Another concern is if you have two diseases, which many of our guys do, they've got chronic kidney disease and Parkinson's, or chronic kidney disease and pancreatic cancer. They only get to apply for one level, not both. In the 9/11 model that you were talking about, a point system is ascribed, a settlement grid's created so that there's value given to every facet of your life that adds up to a total sum. So that part's going to be navigated in the litigation, but the administrative claim part is not looking at those important factors at all.
Yeah, I really think that in many regards, this you can look – knowing how normal civilians operate, not lawyers, but they're going to go over to the far right hand side and say, "Well, I really could use $500,000 right now. I'll take that," without really understanding that that's not really what's being offered here, is it?
It's really not. All that's being offered here is the possibility for you to file a claim if you meet the 22 guiding characteristics that the Navy has set up.
They also have a number of frequently asked questions, which again is a kind of a standard government issue thing, and ask, you know, what if I decline the settlement, what happens, and why only these 9 diseases, and
The other thing is too, is they have a caveat in here that they can withdraw or change this at any time they choose. So, you know, really, it's not like what a standard offer and settlement would be. When you have a standard offer and settlement, both parties are engaging in good faith and trying to actively come to a resolution that meets both needs. This isn't that. This is, we're giving you an opportunity to get an early out if you meet all these criteria. If you don't, move on to the North Carolina litigation. And this is where the judges were concerned. They kept saying, why do we have an administrative process if you're not doing anything during the administrative process? You've got all these claims for 6 months and you're doing nothing with them except dumping them over here onto the North Carolina court system. Well, that's what they've done. Even if someone wanted to apply now, it's going to be 2 years before the Navy's going to be able to get to their claim because they're still so far behind on the ones that were submitted without asking for the offer.
Yeah, as I said, these frequently asked questions also hit on one issue that I know many veterans we've talked to about this, and we don't handle these kind of cases. We leave it to experts like Mike Cox and Catherine Grohl. Will accepting an EO offer affect my VA benefits?
Right.
And then they say, no, accepting an EO offer for a CLJA claim will not affect the claimant's VA benefits. Is there hidden in that answer, but if you don't accept this, you don't know what will happen?
There is. They're suggesting. Now, the VA has published on its website that it is statutorily prohibited from collecting money from the United States government to compensate it for disability claims. So that's been on their website since the Camp Lejeune cases started. The suggestion here from this document is that we're not going to, if you take this early out, you're not going to have to worry about your VA disability. But if you don't, we can't promise that the VA is not going to come after you and reduce your benefits. Now, that would be interesting because the VA and its representatives have been telling all of the Camp Lejeune vets that they're not going to have to pay it back. So that's a little bit of a twisted idea in there that I don't know is accurate.
Yeah, I was really disappointed to read that answer to that frequently asked questions because it sort of was designed to intimidate that. Well, if you get an award or settlement outside of the EO process, it may be offset, is what it says, may be offset by the value of the VA benefits. And that's, I think, contrary to law and seems to me to be trying to unduly influence people. So I'm a little disappointed that it was drafted in that, certainly in that fashion.
I agree with you.
As you look at the national landscape, because I know you have clients all over the country, and as I said, there's there'll be 100,000 of these administrative claims before the year's out, I'm sure. Where do we go from here? Because this isn't going to get these cases out of the North Carolina courts. Do you think the North Carolina court has to turn around and appoint a special master to develop its own matrix of how do we settle these things?
So the good news, Jim, is that is already in process. The leadership committee that the judges have appointed have already been hard at work trying to set up a national database that's going to allow us to do the inputs for all of our clients once they get out of the administrative claim process. And we don't know what all the criteria is going to be. That's being fleshed out right now, and the judge has to sign off on it. Proposals are being submitted for their review. Mike and I will be meeting with the national leadership committees next Wednesday to get updates on where we are with the national models for a settlement grid. So I believe that there will be a few cases tried. They're looking at possibly March or April of next year to try a few what they call bellwether cases, which would be cases that could test out how a jury looks at the evidence and what kind of values they're putting on the cases and what the expert opinions are going to look like so that we'll have a better sense of what we might need to negotiate with. In terms of, you know, let's just say the Navy and the Justice Department come up with a $500,000 settlement on liver cancer. And yet we get a jury verdict of $4 million for liver cancer. We can't go back to our clients and say, take $500 when we know that a jury could value it so much higher. So those things are going to be unfolding over the next 6 months to a year while we navigate this terrain of all the administrative claims that are going to get dumped in North Carolina.
Well, more to follow, and we'll be continuing to update our veteran radio listeners as this progresses, because it affects so many Marines. We're talking to attorney Catherine Grohl, who's our expert on this. Catherine, if people want to reach out to you, where would they find you?
We are at the Mike Cox Law Firm, and we have a website that allows people to come in and ask about anything related to the Camp Lejeune. Mike's got some information posted on there, and he does a great job of outlining what the criteria is and the disease process on there. And then our direct line phone number is 734-591-4002. And our law firm website is MikeCoxLaw.com.
Catherine, we appreciate the time that you've given to Veterans Radio today and to have in the past to keep people updated on this. And we'd very happy if we could reach out to you in the future as this develops over the next 6 or 9 months.
It would be my pleasure, Jim. Thank you so much.
Well, there's a little bit of information you probably didn't know about, and really it's there's been so much advertising on this Camp Lejeune water. We want to bring you the truth as compared to the slick commercials that you get in 30 seconds or 60 seconds. So we hope you enjoyed the Chuck Bewinney story and some update on the issues down at Camp Lejeune here on Veterans Radio. And, you know, this does cost a little money. This is a labor of love, but we do appreciate our sponsors, including VA Healthcare in Ann Arbor, our VSO partners at Vietnam Veterans of America, the Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310, VFW Graff O'Hara Post 423, and American Legion Prescone Post 46. And if you want to participate in helping out Veterans Radio, go to our website at veteransradio.org and click on the sponsorship link. We're in our 20th year and appreciate all that our sponsors do for us, and we're glad to bring you these stories. I'm Jim Fossone, Officer of the Deck. And until next time, when Dale's back on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.